Everybody, thanks for listening to Three Empty Pints this week. If you haven't subscribed to us on your favorite podcasting app, please do. And you can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Acast, Google Play, Auto Radio, and Player FM. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Empty Pints. And if you would like to email us your questions, witticisms, and general disgruntlement, threeemptypints@mail.com. And also, if you'd like to donate, send us money, support us, please do. Click on the tip jar link in this week's episode or visit our website as well.
Chad, why is Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, such a visionary genius?
He really was, actually. What a visionary.
Wow.
What a visionary.
Threw that right over to Chad, and he's just like, I wasn't expecting that intro.
Well, I'm not expecting that, but now I know if I go up to your desk upstairs, there are going to be, you know, envelopes, boxes, and pipe bombs.
Ooh.
So there's that.
That's the basement.
Oh.
I thought Chad was going to have, like, a real
I really thought. I mean, visionary? He's not entirely wrong. He does make sense in my head.
See, I knew this was going to be a battle between you and I versus Chad.
I kind of felt the same way, too. Because I'm reading it, I'm like, he is just going to get pissed off at everything we say in this podcast.
I can't separate the manifesto from mailing bombs to people.
This episode really is about Ted Kaczynski's manifesto, as it has been called, titled Industrial Society and Its Future, or as it's also known as the Unabomber Manifesto. And he breaks it down into very many sections, and he basically, the premise is that technology is taking over not only human society, but humans themselves, and it's stripping humans of their humanness. That's always my term that I use. I don't know if I'm projecting.
Humanity?
Humanity, yeah. And in order to regroup and to keep what makes us human, we must return to nature.
And what year? This was 95?
95, it was out, so.
Yeah.
It was very much in the infancy of the internet, too.
Yes, it was.
So, I mean, when you found this online, it was a big deal.
You downloaded it and you deleted your history.
What we call the dark web these days.
Yeah, and my first copy was the actual photocopy of his typewriter original.
Yeah, that awful scan with the grainy edges.
Yep. It is not a dense, academic-laden text. I think a lot of people think it is because he was an academic, but it's very...
But he was a mathematician.
He was a mathematician. So it is written in a very personable and accessible language. It does contain a lot of dark humor.
But I don't know if he was being funny or...
I think he's just... He had a dark sense of humor.
Funny in his way. His dark,
I don't know that he had a sense of humor.
I think he had a dark sense of
humor. Yeah, he had a dark sense of humor. Yeah. I mean, there's some real sarcasm, just one-liners in this.
Yeah. But I don't know if they were jokes or just his reflections on things.
And he has it broken down, as most crazy obsessive-compulsives do. He has the paragraphs numbered, which makes for a very good reference. Easy reference.
Yes, I really do love that, actually.
Yeah, Angel loves that. So we're going to try to break this down. We're going to see how far we get. But a lot of these things that he talks about, if you are weekly listeners to this podcast, and I hope you are, my God, we talk about a lot of this shit.
It sounds like something Jake would write.
Yeah. if it didn't say industrial society and its future, I feel like it would say Three Empty Pints topics.
It would say Jake ranting about autonomy and the system.
Angel and Chad talk about how fucked up the world is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm maybe not to that extreme because, you know, I don't think I'm planning on blowing any pipe bombs up anytime soon.
No,
but, he has a lot of interesting points. And a lot of stuff kind of makes sense with what we've seen over the last couple of years and are currently seeing.
His opening line is, "The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race." This has been talked about in philosophy and in history. And
I don't think it was any different, but I'm the raging liberal leftist that he rants about. There have always been people in charge.
I didn't quite agree and even understand that first sentence until I read further through when he talks about how certain technologies have come about and were great. The phone, the car, classic examples, how they made life a lot easier. But
I see what he's saying.
Those optional kind of like nice little inventions that made things easier for people eventually became constraints. Like the vehicle, the car is a perfect example. The car was optional. You could still walk wherever you wanted to go, but if you had the money, if you were kind of, you know, well-to-do when cars first came out, you could get a car, which made things easier for you because you can go further, you can travel faster. Now, modern cities, modern culture is based on how you get from point A to point B. You are constrained to having a vehicle. It makes it very difficult for me to walk from one, like just to get here for this podcast. If I walked, it would take me a half a day. Maybe. These technological advances come through as, yeah, this is a nice thing. It's going to make things easier for you. But I don't know if he's trying to twist it as the powers that be eventually use it as a tool to manipulate you and control you.
That's the thing. I don't think there's a lot of, there's not an undercurrent of conspiracy theory in this, at least that I picked up. He might say it, but not say it.
I think he dropped the ball with the transportation thing because he mentions the Industrial Revolution. I don't think cars were as crippling as like coal and steam and factories. How many guys died in coal mines? How many kids were maimed in factories because their little arms could get there?
Yeah. But I don't.
That's valid.
It's more, I think the more of his point is that we've been, humans since the Industrial Revolution have either voluntarily or involuntarily extracted themselves from nature, which is their natural habitat.
Yes, exactly. And technology, although it improves life, eventually creates a codependency that keeps us away from certain things that he feels humans should have access to. Like he's really big on nature. Like, we have to get back to nature. We have to get back to, you know, being farmers and getting our own food and all that.
And really, the idea of this manifesto, it's kind of a letter to a young revolutionary.
Is he advocating? I don't think he's advocating farming, because I think he lampoons that in there, doesn't he?
He lampoons the genetically modified foods, the fact that, again,
but even farming ties you to the land in a way that I don't think he would approve.
I think what he does is he kind of attacks, like, he attacks technology for me to the point where the powers that be kind of manipulate that and control it to the point where they change, alter human behavior. They take away certain human rights and freedoms by utilizing the technology and advancing the technology and changing the technology, like farming, genetically modified food, all of that. Like,
but farming's always been about control, controlling your environment, bending it to your will. But
the angle I get is that now all these scientists and all these elites are changing, they're genetically modifying the food, they're putting chemicals in it, pesticides, all of that shit. And we're also codependent on some of that because, let's be honest, if we didn't have that technology to grow that amount of food, we'd be dead. Like, we can't produce that kind of food without that technology. Otherwise, we would have to go back to, I would say, archaic ways of doing it. And
I think
a lot of people would suffer and die.
Hunter-gathering, not farming. Because they are different.
So let's go through this. Like I said, it's kind of this manifesto to like-minded people, to people who want to start this revolution. And what he's doing, he's laying out the components not only of the revolution, but also of how society is being driven towards this technological or technocratic society, which I found really unusual. He doesn't use the word technocratic. And that's really what he's talking about, is a technocracy at some point.
But I think that term probably came into vogue 5 or 10 years after he wrote it.
Yeah, he does. He uses,
because even though it was in 95, and we've talked about the drafts, I think the formulation of this goes back to him leaving Berkeley.
He uses the term technicians.
Yeah.
So
that's 80s to me.
Yeah, yeah. It is a very 80s term. Yes. In paragraph 4 of the introduction, one of the big thing that I point out when, as he's starting off his talk of the revolution, is he says this is not a political revolution. Its object will be to overthrow non-governments, but the economic and technological basis of the present society.
Isn't that political? To me, it's one and the same.
I think we're seeing it, and that was a lot while I was reading this. I was seeing it through the lens of today, which is a good thing to do, and of that day. And I don't think I don't know if he really was able to see what we have now, which is this type of corporatocracy, where it is the big corporations and it is the government as one entity. Hint to the millennials, it's not capitalism. It's called corporatocracy. That's what you live in.
But he didn't have the resources we have either.
No,
he didn't have the internet.
But he does sort of touch on that. He says that the large corporations and the governments are the ones that are making all those decisions for us.
But they weren't quite as entrenched then as they are now. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. You didn't have Citizens United back then.
Exactly.
I mean, goddamn.
So as we go into past the introduction, his next part is Chad's favorite part. It's called The Psychology of Modern Leftism, paragraph 7, talking about that leftism is a major part of this push towards technocratic society. In order for the revolution to happen, we have to battle back against leftism. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah, He spends so much time lampooning leftism. It's one of his obsessions.
Yes. Is it a segment of society that will fight?
I think his argument against leftism is when you look at the left or people that are extremely left, they fight for, like, the isms. Like, you'll see political correctness, feminism, gay rights, all of that.
Disability rights.
In order to do a lot of those things, you have to kind of shut people off. Like, people who don't agree with these isms have to be silenced. And in order to silence them, you have to create regulations, laws, or shame them in order to get your ideology, you know, through. And that, I think that's what his argument is, because that he feels is a key component to taking away the true freedom of being human.
I think what he talks about in paragraph 7 is that he asked the question, what is leftism? During the first half of the 20th century, leftism could have been practically identified with socialism. Today, the movement is fragmented, and it is not clear who can properly be called a leftist. When we speak of leftists in this article, we have in mind mainly socialists, collectivists, politically correct types, feminists, gay and disability activists, animal rights activists, and the like. Chad does not like that. I saw him shake his head. That's social justice.
Actually, what I was
culture.
Shaking my head at was the first half of the 20th century leftism being associated with socialism.
That I don't agree with.
No, because we remember the classic liberal movements, which he talks about later, but he just disconnected there. And to me, it undermines everything he's saying, because he's not applying that perspective. Socialism and liberalism were not the same thing. That's like saying the alt-right and the Republican orthodoxy are the same thing.
Because libertarianism comes from
the left originally, and now it's a movement of the right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right now, when you look at quote-unquote the left, or as I just call them, as I highlighted here on the end, this is social justice warriorism, they are for socialism.
Yeah.
They completely rail against the capitalist system, which they don't understand capitalism. They don't understand central banking, that it goes hand in hand. Which he doesn't even talk about the central
banks. No, he does.
He does?
He doesn't talk about central banks.
He doesn't say it outright, but he does sort of
say it. Yeah, he talks about how, and this is what, I think this is why I ended up socialist. Like, he and I have a little bit in common. He talks about how you can't just break down part of a system and keep the good parts.
Yeah.
That's my problem with capitalism. I don't see how you get the crony capitalism out of it. Like, that's one of the things I agree with him on. He doesn't say it outright, but in taking what he says about one thing and what he says about something else, you can see him making that argument if this were longer. Mm-hmm. How do you separate them out? How do you keep them? Because he talks about that later on. You can't break down the system and keep the advances in
medicine. There's a lot of contradiction in this.
There is.
And you can tell he's wrestling with this. And
like we do every time we do this.
I think that really is good philosophy, is that you don't pronounce to the world, this is how it is and this is how you live, which he does condemn the left and social justice warriors for
doing that. Yeah.
I mean, and he even talks about the same thing I always talk about. He goes, life is not black and white.
Yeah.
Human existence is not black and white. And the left is trying to make it black and white.
Yes.
But then and the next section's a big part of it. The feelings of inferiority, I think he doesn't have empathy. And that goes along with, you know, the personality of someone capable of mailing people bombs. I don't think he can put himself in the mindset or the position of anyone else.
Yeah, in paragraph 10, he runs over this feelings of inferiority, which the alt-right has to have read this, because they lampoon this type of effeminate or cuckold type of thinking continually. Correct?
You don't. Oh, they do.
Yeah.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. And how many of them are married? Not many of them. So what do they know about cuckolding or being cuckolded?
I don't want to get.
Oh, wait. It's their obsession with big black cock cuckolds guy on Pornhub.
I don't want to get off track, but they laugh about effeminate young men, social justice warriors, not being married or being able to find anybody. But at the same time, I'm thinking, but you alt-righters, in the same way, how many percent of the women in this time are going to listen to you about staying in the kitchen and making babies?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Wear your white polo shirt and come home with a black eye, and she's going to be like, no, fuck this. Like, you're going to end up in prison. You lost your job because you're out there with a tiki torch. I'm out. You know, yeah, talk shit, assholes. Anyway.
But here, I did find in paragraph 11 of that section, I got a good kick out of this. As he's describing the modern-day SJW mentality, he says, this tendency is pronounced among minority rights activists, whether or not they belong to the minority groups whose rights they defend. They are hypersensitive about the words used to denigrate minorities and about anything that is said concerning minorities. Woo! Wow,
different versions.
Yeah. And he doesn't even go with the usual slang that we know about.
Yeah, well, he talks about in the next the terms Negro, Oriental, Handicap, or Chick, which I found amazing because modern-day feminists rail against this word.
Mm-hmm. They do?
They hate the word Chick. I use Chick all the time. I've used it forever. And it's not a derogatory term.
Yeah, or even the old term broad from the from like the early
20th
century.
I don't use that one, but chick, like chick I learned from chicks.
But usually a chick means she's super cool.
Yeah.
She's kick ass.
She's one of the guys.
They're merely the feminine equivalents of guy, dude, or fellow.
Yeah.
So it's just like saying, hey, dude, what's up, bro?
But how obviously is this a upper middle class white guy with what he considers normal?
And here's the big thing that I get, and this is the thing I call white savior complex.
Ooh. Oh,
this is white savior complex. This is what
WSC.
This is what I nail on Chat all the time. He talks about this
in
paragraph 12.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Those who are most sensitive about political incorrect terminology are not the average black ghetto dweller, Asian immigrant, abused woman, or disabled person, but a minority of activists, many of whom do not even belong to any oppressed group, but come from privileged strata of society.
Mm-hmm.
Political correctness has its stronghold among university professors who have secure employment with comfortable salaries, and the majority of whom are heterosexual white males from middle to upper class families. In 13, he says, the lefts themselves feel that these groups are inferior.
Mm. And they're there to save them.
I'm not bringing them.
You cringed when I was talking about 12 rebuttal. This is white savior complex.
See, I'm not going to defend the white professors. I mean, that's an issue, and it does need to be talked about.
Okay, so if it's a black professor.
No, just activists don't need to be part of a group to represent them.
But you know why later on he says because they want power.
Sometimes, but, you know, talking about disabled people, people with intellectual disabilities, can they advocate for themselves? A few of them can, not all of them can. Isn't it incumbent on us to stick up for them? Doesn't that make us... Do I need to have, as he says, an inferiority complex to stick up for other people? No, he talks about bullies later on, and here's that lack of empathy, and I don't get why he can't put them together. People stand up to bullies. The people who stand up to bullies don't always have an inferiority complex. Sometimes it's just like...
They're just protective.
Yeah, fuck you. Like, why do you need to put them down? Like... You know, it's the people putting them down who have the inferiority complex. Sometimes there are people who are just, you know, raging against the machine.
I think he's a passive observer of humanity.
Yes.
So when you're a passive observer, you're just kind of taking in only a certain segment of things.
Yeah.
And you don't ever have that emotional connection.
I agree with you.
He could even be talking about his own experience being at Harvard and Berkeley, seeing those elites do what they do. Maybe that's his impression of them.
Oh, I think that's where a lot of it comes from.
But we're emotional too. I don't think we can ever separate ourselves from emotion. I mean, we've been in a room watching sports together. There's yelling. There's profanity. There's
pounding. We yell at each other during this podcast.
Yeah, so. We're emotional people. We can't separate ourselves from that. And if that's in your personality, in your nature, it's when you're watching sports. It's when you see somebody getting bullied. It's, you know, when you're at home.
It is very interesting that he does say that, you know, although they, you know, they are activists and all that about these groups, that they do feel like those people are inferior to them. I find that fascinating because it's kind of, I kind of think that's true.
I think it is for some people. Yeah. I think for people like Chad who really want to help.
Yeah.
And want to do good for these people that the government doesn't give a fuck about, but they say they do. That's why they take your tax money, Angel.
That's his premise. He's not picking on just, and you know, he's not just picking on Chad. He's picking on those extreme leftist ideals, those power hungry assholes who use that ideology or whatever the fuck you want to call it to manipulate and control. And he kind of touches on a lot of shit.
And here's the one thing that he brings up in paragraph 16 that is exactly what this social justice warrior culture is. He says the leftist is anti-individualistic, pro-collectivist. He wants society to solve everyone's problem for them, satisfy everyone's needs for them, take care of them. He is not the sort of person who has an inner sense of confidence in his ability to solve his own problems and satisfy his own needs. The leftist is antagonistic to the concept of competition because deep down inside he feels
like a loser.
And this, I'm telling you, the alt-right has read this because this goes along with the cuckold.
Mm-hmm.
They rage on these effeminate, young social justice warriors.
And I disagree with this. I mean, I played sports. You know, when I play games, like, I play to win.
But here's the thing.
And I'm hyper-competitive.
Here's the thing, Chad. I disagree with some of it, but really, it is the anti-individualistic pro-collectivist that is absolutely positively true about this movement that we see.
And I probably espouse that to an extent.
You do kind of do the he wants society to solve everyone's problems for them. You do have that kind of ideal.
To an extent,
which is impossible. But that could be another reason why he focuses and attacks them, because he even points out they need technology in order to push that kind of
and
agenda.
Here's where I have it listed, where he never uses it because he was a mathematics head, so he doesn't know what literary critical social theory is. I have a degree in English. I know where it is. And he talks about it here in paragraph 18. Modern leftist philosophers tend to dismiss reason, science, objective reality, and to insist that everything is culturally relative.
But the right does the same thing.
But it is obvious that modern leftist philosophies are not simply cool-headed
logicians systematically analyzing the foundations of knowledge.
They are deeply involved emotionally in their attack on truth and reality. They attack these concepts because of their own psychological needs. For one thing, their attack is an outlet for hostility, and to the extent that it is successful, it satisfies the drive for power.
Going back to his power complex or process or whatever the hell he calls it.
See, and I disagree with that because I can't, you know, when I see leftist, I identify as left, and I don't know, that doesn't sound like me to me.
In paragraph 19, the leftist feelings of inferiority are so ingrained that he cannot conceive of himself as individually strong and viable.
Valuable.
And valuable. Hence the collectivism of the leftist. He can feel strong only as a member of a large organization or a mass movement with which he identifies himself. And this is something I rage about all the time with the millennials. They see themselves not as an individual, but, oh, I'm hashtag.
I'm part of something bigger than myself.
Yeah. Me too. Me too. Yeah. Let's hashtag.
All right. Let's tweet it.
Yes.
To see. Ah!
No.
No. I knew this was going to be.
Yeah. Yes.
I hate you guys. No, but you can be individually strong and part of something bigger than yourself.
Of course you can.
But he can't separate them. To him, if you're part of anything bigger than yourself, well, then you're worthless. And you don't see any value in yourself individually.
I have the my border highlighted with LOL on this one.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Paragraph 22. If our society had no social problems at all, the leftists would have to invent problems in order to provide themselves with an excuse for making a fuss.
I agree.
I
feel like they are always trying to come up with some kind of bullshit to push some kind of fucking agenda.
Look at the Harvey Weinstein. Harvey Weinstein is a great example. This is a problem that has been well known, well documented, everyone knows. But as soon as this is out, the feministas jump all over this.
Yep.
Speaking personally, if there were no social injustice or social issues, I'd find a different job and I'd be okay with it. Like, that'd be great.
The problem is you're not a lefty. And I think
you're not.
I think we're slowly wearing you down.
No, I think you're struggling right now. I think
I've always been a lefty. Always.
I think you always have been, but since we started this, you kind of
No, I'm not 100% lefty. I'm about 78%.
We know that. But I don't know, Chad.
There's bullshit there. I recognize that. I admit that, and it needs fixed. I think there's more bullshit on the right.
I think he sort of acknowledges that many times. I think he acknowledges the fact that, again, there's a lot of bullshit with that whole leftist ideal. But it's not all fucked up. It is not all people who believe in leftism or liberal or whatever the hell he's getting to.
Well, his next section's really interesting. It goes back to something we talked over socialization, coming from somebody with no empathy and no social skills. And that wasn't his fault. You know, I forget if we mentioned this. He started at Harvard when he was 16. You know, he skipped two grades in high school. He never fit in.
No.
Never,
no, never fit
in
the mold.
His life. Yeah. Even when he was in grad school, he was smarter than his professors. He didn't fit in.
Yeah.
He never had friends that he could talk to as an equal. You know, there was, I don't think he ever had a social circle.
What does this section say to you over socialization? As we
to
go?
Me, it says loner. I mean, it screams that. Like, over socialization, that's for people who have friends. And it's justifying and trying to compensate for that. It's the inferiority complex that he just rampaged about in the previous section.
This is probably the weirder section to me. And I have things highlighted.
Because we all had friends in a social circle.
But I think he doesn't mean socialization. Yeah. in that, okay, you went out and you played with your friends. It's kind of a cultural cultural programming.
It goes back to what you said in an earlier podcast where you said, I don't like being part of a society because a society puts rules and morals that I have to follow. And no matter what, if I am part of this society, I have to follow those rules and regulations. That is what he's getting at. He's getting at the over-socialization to me means now there are all these rules, there are all these regulations, there are all these laws or whatever that are telling me that I have to be a certain person, act a certain way, say a certain... That's what I'm getting in that first paragraph there. A person is said to be well-socialized if he believes and obeys the moral code of his society and fits in well as a functioning part of that society.
But going down to paragraph 26, thank you for numbering these, Ted.
Thank you.
Over-socialization can lead to low self-esteem, a sense of powerlessness, defeatism, guilt, etc. These are all things that somebody with no friends, no social supports, no social circle, no close family has. I think he's misidentifying these. And then going down a little bit, if this is overdone, or if a particular child is especially susceptible to such feelings, he ends by feeling ashamed of himself.
And here, I have a section highlighted in paragraph 26 near the bottom. Thus, the over-socialized person is kept on a psychological leash and spends his life running on rails that society has laid down for him. I think that that's what he's saying, that this over-socialization is that we are being over-societized, that kids are being taught this is the right moral code. This is this, and this is what you have to leave. This is how you have to live it. And this is what infects modern lefties.
Exactly. He's touching on more like human behavior and like the engineering of human behavior, I think. He starts touching on it with the over-socialization part because he does get into the human engineering part after this.
Wait, can we go back to 27?
Yeah,
before you go
27,
to
I have a...
Notice that university intellectuals constitute the most highly socialized segment of our society and also the most left-wing segment.
We see that now in 2017.
Yeah, exactly.
You still don't agree. I don't agree.
Oh my God, Chad.
Won't agree.
You have to... I mean, That right there was resounding.
Now, is it because you went to a public school and I went to a private liberal arts college?
That could be it.
Yeah.
Because there are more public professors than there are private professors. And to me, some of them try really hard, some of them don't. You know, they're civil servants at the end of the day.
I would probably say that was more true when you guys went to college, but I would think at this point, the majority of colleges and universities...
I think it's very hard for people, even when I was in college, I think people have a very hard understanding of what a liberal arts education is versus public education at college. I don't think people understand that there is a very different philosophy involved. And the most simplistic thing I would try to break this down for people back in the day and still today is that liberal arts education gives you this quote-unquote this all-around
education
aspect that it's not necessarily preparing you for anything, even though there are plenty of people who became lawyers, doctors, blah, 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 but it's giving you this insight in a way that you can go out into the world and try to figure things out.
A public school education is about getting a degree for a job.
Yeah, it's about the factory.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I don't want to. And when so I say that, people are like, "Oh, you're a
so
dick."
Basically, if you're going to be a historian, you're going to study history. If you're going to be a mathematician,
if you're going to be a social worker, you get a social work degree.
A liberal arts college will kind of tell you about everything. Like,
yeah, liberal arts education.
Yeah, you know. So you're going to what? I guess you're going to learn about the arts and music and.
Well, you're married to one who's got a liberal arts degree.
She is, but she's kind of a. I don't know. She's kind of a rebel.
Well, no, and that is part of it. And I think there are more professors at state schools. I mean, they're bigger by and large. There are more of them.
Again, you disagree with me on this premise. But when we talk about modern social justice warriors, The social engineers targeted liberal arts colleges mm-hmm. because of the people who went there, because they were, quote unquote, more liberal minded. Mm-hmm. Not as in liberalism politically, but that they were open to people going, hey, I'm gay. Well, yeah, that's cool. I don't care.
They were about all the isms, the political correctness and all that. Yeah, before it was an ism.
Do you get what I'm saying now?
I mean, my school had drag competitions. You know, my school was a state school, but damn, was it liberal politically.
That's true. That yeah. can happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
It's not a black and white.
We had, and I quote, the gayest art department in the country. And this was a source of pride.
I will tell you that your college is quite known for its art department.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. I mean,
it is.
I remember at one point they have a drag competition at my school every year. The cash prize is $5,000. I was very serious about entering this one year. I'm not a drag queen, but it's a $5,000 prize. And me and my...
Wait, you lefty? Weren't you afraid of offending the pure drag queen?
Yeah, no, I wanted $5,000. And I was trying to figure out if there were enough fractures in the art department art department could carry this. We did not have the numbers.
I want to argue something now. I don't even consider myself a lefty, but I would say, you know what? I'm not of that social standing. I'm not of that culture, subculture, or culture.
Jake, I'm 5 feet tall. I could look like one hot, sexy bitch.
No. I'm saying is that is not my place. I don't want to take away from someone of that place who deserves it.
Oh.
Does that make me more of a lefty than you?
Well, see, here's where I'm all about competition.
True lefty,
I think it does.
I'm about competition and the free market.
See, not a crony crypto lefty.
I have said for years I'm the most non-competitive person you will ever meet. I don't give a fuck about being competitive.
Unless you're paying FIFA. Then he wants to kick your ass.
Then he'll fucking kick you in the ankles. He'll
pretend like he doesn't care, but really he wants to whoop your ass.
Yeah.
But here, I did highlight something in paragraph 28
changing the subject
that really pisses that really
how
pisses.
Very left of you.
I'm just trying to keep
Jake's trying to advocate for himself. What a fucking hippie scumbag!
You fucking scumbag!
I guess I really am a pure leftist.
Yeah!
I win! This has taken one hell of a swing.
Anyways, Chad, he sums up lefties in paragraph 28.
Oh, man.
On the contrary, the left takes an accepted moral principle, adopts it as its own, and then accuses mainstream of society of violating that principle. How can you argue that?
I'm not going to argue. I think that's a fringe element. And I think it's exaggerated and overblown a lot of times.
Christ.
No, whatever. There's a vocal minority who does it. And he says that later on. Your average Joe and Linda left aren't doing that.
Which is, I found amusing. He does have a dark sense of humor. Angel's favorite part, the power process.
The power process, wow.
Ugh.
Yeah, this is a, I didn't really enjoy this either, but I get what he's saying.
I mean, I just found it really intriguing, the power process. Human beings have the need for something that we call the power process. This is closely related to the need for power. And then in quotations, which is widely recognized, but is not quite the same thing. The power process has four elements. The three most clear-cut of these we call goal, effort, and attainment of goal. So, I don't know. Like, what I got from this section was that primitive man had certain needs.
Yes.
Like, we have the need to eat. We have the need to find a place that's warm for us to sleep. We want to stay warm, and we want to fuck.
If he weren't raging about academia, he probably would have quoted Maslow.
So, like, I don't know. This whole section to me seems like the whole technology industrial complex thing that he's arguing is saying that, you know, you've taken a lot of those satisfactory things that man has had and made it a lot easier. So you make things for people easier with technology. You know, I can just go to the grocery store and get food. I can just go and get satisfaction from something easily, so we get bored. So then he goes into mass media and movies, and of course now we have Facebook and all that. People find different avenues to get that power process satisfaction. And he even goes deeper, because then he starts talking about those crazy leftists and their ideologies. Even the guy he talks about way further on with the whole nuclear power plant thing.
Well, that's the next part of that, where he breaks down this power process of humanity. He calls it the surrogate activities. Mm-hmm. And basically, the surrogate activity is when people do not have to exert themselves to satisfy that physical needs, they often set up artificial goals for themselves.
Correct.
And this is the thing he rages about.
Yes, he's very, very adamant about pushing the power process throughout the entire manifesto. Yes. He's very adamant in saying people have been manipulated and controlled by technology and industry, and they're using that to take away a lot of those, you know, the power process, that thing that we need innately as people, like that satisfaction that we get from, again, we go back to primitive man, killing that deer or whatever and getting that food now has become those activities. You know, you're part of a social program.
Well, that's what he says. And in paragraph 39, we use the term surrogate activity to designate an activity that is directed towards an artificial goal that people have set up for themselves merely in order to have some goal to work towards,
yes.
Or let us say merely for the quake of the fulfillment that they get from pursuing that goal.
Yes.
And down in paragraph 40, he says, in modern industrial society, not only minimal effort is necessary to satisfy one's physical needs, that we've created these bullshit.
Yes. I think they're distractions, but they're those small little social kind of hobbies or mannerisms, you know, whatever. You know, you're part of a bowling club or you're part of an Antifa movement or something stupid like that, where you could put your head behind an ideal or you could put yourself behind a movement, and that's how you get that primitive satisfaction that he keeps talking about.
What he's talking about, and I had to quick look his name up. He's a philosopher. He also considers himself he says he's an anthropologist. His name is David Graeber, and he talks about this phenomenon. It's called the bullshit job. Mm-hmm. That modern society, we filled our lives with these stupid tasks,
yeah.
Like middle management. Corporate middle management is a bullshit job.
Yeah.
We don't really know what Ted does back there in his office. He makes $70,000 a year.
Yeah.
We don't know what he does. We just see him CC'd on email after email.
But yeah.
We don't know what this fucking guy contributes.
But he goes further, because how does Ted get his satisfaction? Ted gets his satisfaction by exerting his authority and power on you by sending you that fucking email that pisses you off, even though you know what you're doing in your job. But since he's a middle manager, how does Ted get his rocks off? Because he's telling you what to do, and he's receiving that power process fulfillment.
And here it is. All of us have worked in this environment, and we've railed against this. He says this in paragraph 40, or the only requirements are a moderate amount of intelligence and, most of all, simple obedience.
Exactly.
You company man. You fairy.
Exactly.
Which you have said forever.
Exactly. But, and what he's getting at, what Kaczynski is getting at, is he's saying, instead of having the simplistic fulfillment of, again, getting up in the morning, finding your food, raising your crops, fucking your wife, whatever, now you get up, you go to a mundane job, you're a middle manager, you get your fulfillment, your satisfaction, your power from doing your stupid mundane job, hobby, whatever. And that applies to everything, whether you're part of an activist group, whether you're some middle management fucking some corporation somewhere. Everybody is pushing to fulfill that primitive need. It's all about, we're biological and psychologically hardwired for that. I truly believe that.
How much of this was, you know, we all went to shithole jobs in our lives. And I think I can speak for the three of us. We have work ethic. Even when we had shit jobs or jobs we hated or jobs we despised, we still showed up every day and gave it everything we had.
We still talk about the sense of satisfaction stocking a shelf.
Yeah, because you went in and you did your shit until it was time to go home. And there was a pride in that. Is that obedience or is that work? Like, what's the difference between obedience and work?
I think it's like I said, the angel, he's railing against the company man. You just have this obedience to corporate propaganda.
He even talks about, and I forgot what paragraph it is, but there's a part where he talks about there are certain people that go to a job and they will go up and be on the call of duty for a shit fucking job that is super easy. But that's how they get their fulfillment. And I identified with that. My job is easy. What I do is easy. I go up and above and beyond because I frankly get bored with what I do. Because I know, and I hate to say it, I am more intelligent than the majority of the people I work with. I'm sorry. It bothers me that idiotic things that these people can't do. So I will do those extra things.
Well, that's why you're the elite of the podcasting world, Angel.
No, but that's I do that. Because I get a certain sense of satisfaction. That's how I get my satisfaction to my day. I don't go in and do the... There are people who will do just enough to get by. And that's what those middle class or that stupid, like right under the poverty line jobs are for. That stupid flipper of burgers at Burger King. Sorry. Or that guy that works at the office conglomerate. That just... He makes $8.50 an hour or whatever the hell minimum wage is. They will do what they have to do because they have to survive in the system, as he calls it. I will go up and above and beyond because that's how I get my satisfaction. I can go home at the end of the day saying I did everything I could at my job.
And that's why he rails against the left, because the left wants to always take care of those people that are at the bottom that probably just want to be at the bottom and that's it.
And again, he talks about
and
that.
And Chad's biting him. Chad. Yeah.
But it is true. It is true. When people start to separate themselves, the left, and I'm not saying everyone, they do tend to say, oh, well, you know, we can't leave them behind. We have to give them a fair shake. I don't believe in that. I think
that is always their argument about quote unquote capitalism. But at the same time, they don't take into effect that human beings will always try to separate themselves from each other. That pure equality cannot be had because humans always want to better themselves.
To me, that is the power.
And there's always a segment of people that don't give a fuck.
And that is the power process to me. That's what he is explaining in the power process.
And here's where I'm not all the way on the left. You know, there are people who try harder and there are people who give more. They are not always properly rewarded for what they put in, and we can go back to our experience at the retail conglomerate, and I think we can all empathize
and
with
that. I totally agree with what you're saying, but there are a lot of people who work hard and do that extra effort and don't get credit like you say, but there's plenty of people that see that, take advantage of that, and there are other apologists who want to feel sorry for those
people.
How
many
people
skated by because the three of us busted our ass?
Exactly. Yeah, that happens. But there's always that apologetic asshole who's like, oh, well, that's because of blah, 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 whatever his problem is. And that's bullshit to me. That's bullshit. Whereas in his ideal, if we're all on the same level playing field and we don't have that shit, the weak die and the strong survive.
See, I don't believe in that level playing field. I don't think it actually exists, and that's where I disagree with him.
I mean, that's human nature. It's what it is. I mean, I get the fact that, you know, leftists want to play the, oh, we have to give everybody a fair shake, but sometimes, I don't know. If you're not willing to put the effort in, then why should the rest of society have to bring you along?
But I think that's the misconception about what some people on the left believe, that, you know, to me, it's about giving people a fair shake, not only because it's good for them in that collectivist sense, but because it's good for all of us if people can advance, if the actual best do rise to the top. That's not always what happens because we've got nepotism, you know, we've got favoritism, we've got people who just don't like that guy.
Again, that is your leftist response, and you say, well, that's why we have affirmative action. But it doesn't take into account even those people who have been selected to move up from affirmative action may not have the skills, may not have the qualifications to do
they
it.
They simply get it because of their economic
and then again, the left, the lefty never takes into account that just because that person was elevated through affirmative action, they don't or will not exhibit nepotism?
I don't believe that. People get up there and they do what's best for them.
Power corrupts.
Yeah,
This is the thing that no one gets. Power corrupts, power corrupts, power corrupts.
Yeah. And we all agree on it. We disagree on how it manifests.
The other thing that I take away from the surrogate activities part, and I don't know if this ties into the power process, but he makes a big, big point about it's not just about finding these other surrogate bullshit things for people to get attached to. Eventually, it comes down to obedience. When you're in these groups, when you're part of these cliques, again, there's structure. There are rules. There are certain things you do. You meet at certain times. Again, it turns into another structure of control.
Here's more of the hypocrisy of this, though. Isn't writing a manifesto a surrogate activity? Because he didn't need to survive.
He talks about that art is a surrogate activity as well.
And
yeah,
intellectualism, which... A manifesto? Come on.
I mean, it's, there's no doubt about it. There's a lot of contradictions in what he's saying, but I think, again,
and
it goes
I think they're
back,
worth pointing out.
Yeah.
Oh, know, yeah.
It's,
but again, he's, I think this is one of those call to arms. So when it's a call to arms, you.
You
I'm
get
not,
away with the hypocrisy exactly. that yes. you would lampoon yes. the left for.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Look, he does make fun of conservatives, too.
Oh, he does.
Bit. He only needs two paragraphs.
We're almost there.
Which you absolutely love.
Oh, I do.
Are you ready
to
go into sources of social problems, which is his next
Well,
part.
Wait. There's autonomy, which he actually autonomy addresses is, later yeah. on in a better way
I think
than
Angel,
I think he does
here. He does bounce around.
Yeah, Angel, I think, kind of summed up autonomy pretty good. There's...
I mean, it ties all that together. His process, his power process, his, you know, it's, you know, they're taking that away. They're making us more obedient.
Yep.
We need to go back to being the small community. We need to go back to knowing our neighbor and confiding in our neighbor and actually taking our lives into our neighbor's hands. Like when you're in trouble, your neighbors were the ones who bailed you out, not big government. Not fucking, you know.
But
the,
it's even
the
funny. He even talks about as we get further into it. He even goes small communities, and this thing is just kind of a pipe dream, anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's gotten too big. Yeah. The
well,
whole
his
industrial
brother
complex.
Bailed him out. I mean, speaking of the hypocrisy
again, if we want to go lefty, who supported Karl Marx forever?
Well, yeah, Engels? Marx was upper.
Yeah, who played this? Oh, I'm just this poor schmuck intellectual who lives off of the light of the library. Yeah. No, you weren't. You're a phony. Isn't that most intellectuals?
I think it's most philosophers. I feel like there
Even
are intellectuals
Socrates?
Who have...
Was Socrates a philosopher?
Yeah.
He surely was.
Yeah.
Oh,
he slept with his students. But anyway.
Well, he was a professor. It all comes full circle. Doesn't
it does.
It? Look at that. He was the high class professor back in Greece and was fucking his students.
They always have and they always will.
Yeah, because they just get so
Is
close.
That the power principle?
It's a power process, yeah.
As we move into sources of social problems, and in this section he goes over... Oh, I knew you would like this one.
Yeah.
I have this highlighted on each side.
Yeah.
And in this section, he goes over why society is breaking down. Primitive man has been, you know, we've been extracted from our natural society. He's talking about people moving into cities and how the psychological effects of being in these dense, polluted spaces, noisy spaces.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting because psychologists have been talking about this forever.
And social geographers, even though
forget,
you hate the intellectual
slant,
about, but
again,
no, it's true. You're
going,
right.
Getting into the cities, and remember that technology creates the big, booming, bustling cities and industrial complex and automobiles and all that. But crowding, he talks about.
And the aggression and the
and
hustling
the aggression
and, the,
and
scamming.
The hostility. And we go back to an older episode where we talked about people or tribal. Again, we go back to those primitive biological needs. We tend to separate from each other. So if we're crowded and we're up against people, we're going to butt heads. We're not going to like how our neighbor fucking does, plays his Spanish music late at night when I'm trying to sleep or whatever. Because now in the cities, you have cultural differences kind of melting together, your famous little melting pot.
He calls it a stable framework. Mm-hmm. In paragraph 49, he talks about a stable framework, which leads into paragraph 50,
which Chad is Chad's favorite.
He's been salivating.
So just go right the hell ahead.
Oh, God, I'm going to come. Okay, paragraph 50. The conservatives are fools. They whine about the decay of traditional values, yet they enthusiastically support technological progress and economic growth. Apparently, it never occurs to them that you can't make rapid, drastic changes in the technology and the economy of a society without causing rapid changes in all other aspects of the society as well, and that such rapid change inevitably break down traditional values.
Yeah, and I totally agree with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and it's stark to me. I mean, he spent sections and paragraphs tearing down liberalism and leftism, and conservatism only merited a paragraph, but mm-hmm. in that paragraph, he so eloquently destroyed our modern conservative ideals.
Yeah.
I think William F. Buckley should be here to refute.
No, but he's
such
right.
Groups.
I mean, it is a hypocrisy. I mean, they want to sit there and talk about that shit, like, oh, we need to get back to traditional family values and all that bullshit. But they
make America
they
great
are,
again.
They are the proponents of economic growth, taking technology to the next level, improving life.
That's what destroyed the traditional family.
Exactly. That's what's fucking things up.
But now the left is all about the growth of technology. The left is totally immersed in Silicon Valley and all that money.
But they're not telling you about the traditional family.
His perspective on the left's codependency on technology is they're using it as an avenue of control. They're using it to spread their message.
Yeah.
To change people's behaviors and the way they think.
The right's trying to do that, and at the same time bitching about how things aren't the way they used
to be.
Anybody
who listens to this podcast knows that we're not idiots, and we know that the left and the right are basically the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
They're pushing different...
But at least the left is saying we want to change shit. The right is changing shit, and then, why is it different now?
I think on both sides, whether you're conservative or liberal, there's a lot of us out there that want real change, that want to go back to making things, I don't know, simpler or better or whatever. But his argument to me is that the leftists use the technology to manipulate and control. The conservatives are just hypocrites. They just use it as an avenue to...
But they use
whatever.
It to control, too, if we dig
they do,
deep enough.
But
I have a paragraph 51. I have something highlighted that I found interesting when you talk about that. He says, beyond that, a technological society has to weaken family ties and local communities mm-hmm. if it is to function efficiently. Mm-hmm. In modern society, an individual's loyalty must first be to the system and only secondary to a small-scale community because if the internal loyalties of a small-scale communities were stronger than loyalty to the system, such communities would pursue their own advantage at the expense of the system.
Correct.
And I kind of saw that when he talks about, we're talking about traditional values and the conservatives, and it has to weaken family ties. This is something that conservatives right now rail against the left, that the traditional family has been weakened. Everyone works. Nobody, the kids aren't taken care of. We give our kids to the system. I talk about this constantly mm-hmm. in that podcast.
Yeah.
We've given our families to the system.
Yeah, and even when families are quote unquote together, what are they doing? One's on an iPad, one's on an iPhone, one's on an Android, whatever. They're not paying attention to each other.
And
Facebooking, Twittering, all that.
And
shit.
I don't even come from the conservative viewpoint of a traditional family, which is a man and his wife and his kids. I think two gay men can raise a child just as well as anyone, and maybe if not better. Mm-hmm. I'm not that might even make. I'm coming out as the real lefty in this now, Chad.
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen it firsthand.
Yeah.
I was in the city of brotherly love this past 2 weekends ago, and I did see a gay couple with a daughter who was enjoying herself and looked like a completely normal, fun, loving, happy child.
And statistically, they're less likely to physically abuse her. They're less likely to neglect her, if only because they probably adopted her. You know, they're less likely to sexually abuse her.
But I don't
obviously.
Even, I don't even go to that. I go to the fact that it looked like two normal, functioning human beings who wanted to raise a child for their own.
And that's all they
and
were
just
parents.
And they were taking their kid to the zoo. That's all it was. And it was a beautiful thing. It really was. I mean, there were lots of kids there. Obviously, it's a zoo, so you see different cultures in society. But
and this, there are two parents. But with the
it kid. Didn't. It didn't even dawn. It didn't even like you know. It's like okay, there's a gay couple with their kid. Like to me, it was just two parents with their kid.
Yeah, you guys both sound really liberal right now.
Because we are liberal.
Oh, I know.
I think all of us at this table, we have a little bit of everything. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a staunch conservative. I'm not wearing the white polo shirts, Chad.
Oh, that's all right.
and telling everyone I'm a white European.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I'm just a guy
Wait,
who...
Wait, you are Puerto Rican. That's
I am
blue
Puerto
blood.
Rican. Yeah, that's... yeah. I am a blue blood. Yeah. I am a blue
are
blood.
Are you Catalonian?
I'm
are
actually related to Lionel Messi, actually. So.
Oh,
he's Argentinian. Don't be related.
Oh, he's not. Oh,
oh
okay.
Yeah, he's Argentinian.
Oh, he is. Oh, yeah. Shit. I don't know. I don't think about any of that stuff.
But then here's
me.
Where I struggle because you're saying that, and then you know he's saying, oh, they're standing up for the gays. There are people in this country who want to make what you saw illegal, and they're up in arms and they're out. Oh, those gays! They're gonna
but
make her the gays.
I will
She's
say
gonna catch
I will
the
I
gays.
Will say this. He doesn't actually talk about it, but those that kind of I that kind of. Thinking is no different than what he says to the left. Those people again are just like the leftists he talks in here. They're using that fear mongering, that whatever they need, technology, Twitter, all that, to send that message out of hate or whatever it is to get that measure of control. That's all it is. It happens on both sides. He just happens to mention the left a lot. That's it.
I think it's not the left. And he doesn't, and he doesn't use the word ideology like I do. But that's what he's railing against is that this brainwashed people mm-hmm. that are just reciting phrases
exactly
that they don't come from it from a pure hearted way. They're phonies or they're just brainwashed. I think they're saying.
They're either the phonies or the power hungry assholes at the top. Or they're the poor, unfortunate souls who have got sucked into it and have been brainwashed to believe this bullshit.
Right, and he does make that at the end. He does make that differential.
He's very, very adamant about
and it's like
that.
Chad always gets wound up about. He's like, look, there's actually good people that, when they call themselves social justice, they really are just trying to help the poor.
He does talk about that, though.
Yeah, he does.
He says that there are people, there are social justice warriors that do good.
Yeah,
but there are the social justice warriors who are out for their own power struggle,
and
to
that's
how
we see
ahead.
Today.
Yeah,
it's about
in
coercion.
It for the Twitter followers and the political contributions.
And I think the best thing about that section of sources of social problems, the one thing I highlighted was paragraph 57, is that he said change is imposed. I take that as a good takeaway from this section. That change is imposed on him.
But then he says, whereas the 19th century frontiersman had the sense that he created change himself by his own choice.
Yep.
He didn't. He was told about manifest destiny. He was told, seize the West. You know, take the white destiny from the Indian.
Oh,
that was a myth, too.
Here we go. Social justice for the white.
No, but he was
Come
told.
On. Come on.
He was told what to do.
Let's argue this right now.
Okay.
I'm saying
he was told what to do the same
way.
No.
This I find. So we always joked about this growing up. Oh, Christopher Columbus and they came and the Indians. Ha, ha, ha. We joked about it because we know history in the context of what it was, imperialism. These kids don't see it as imperialism. They just see it as the white man came and they took the dark-skinned.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
it's imperialism, manifest destiny. That's what it was.
But I don't go along with it just because they were white. They necessarily saw the Indians, I said Indians, as dark-skinned and we can steal everything.
They were just somebody different and we were us and we took what they had.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what it was.
That's all it breaks down.
It had nothing to do with ism.
That wasn't a choice. They were told, this is our destiny. It's what we as Americans are entitled to. We're exceptional. American exceptionalism.
But
God wants us to have this.
But American exceptionalism is imperialism.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But that wasn't...
I think you... No, I keep on saying you. But I think you get so wound up sometimes. And I think...
I hear these these code words.
Yeah, I know. I really get fired up because you're
a brainwashed liberal.
Yeah, I guess.
But I think that's part of the alt-right's thing, that they love imperialism. They love when they talk about, and I know we bandy this about, and everyone's got a different definition for MAGA, and I just see it as the old industrial type of America. People had jobs, you know, stable families, things like that. I really think that's what MAGA, you know, is. And then, of course, the lefties take it one way. But this exceptionalism that's been bandied about on both the left and the alt-right specifically, the left goes, there's nothing exceptional about this country because we bomb everybody. That's true. We are owned by the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. and it's all about imperialism. But it's not even about imperialism. It's just about bombing people to make money for shits and giggles.
See, yeah. I think American exceptionalism does exist to an extent, and they're going to take my liberal card. But I I think part of it is we took the best and the brightest from so many other places. And that's what made it exceptional for so long.
I don't think we took. I think they came here because they could express themselves.
And, yeah. I mean, we brain drained the rest of the world.
Yeah, but we did that also, you know, according to him, to push our technological and industrial strength.
Was it organized here, or was it just, I can do better there? I don't know that we had the control or authority to pull them. I think, like Jake said, they came here, but what made America great.
Well, I mean, a lot of the German scientists that came over here during the war came over here because it was what, you come over here or what, you die or you're in prison?
Well, it wasn't just them, though. I mean, it was before that. And it was after that.
I'm just using that as an example. But, I mean, isn't that maybe what our government did? It's like, oh, well, you know, we kind of rule over you, so you can die or you can come work for us.
That was true in one specific case. I mean, you know, after we went over there and kicked their teeth in, you know, and said, we're in charge, we make the rules. Yeah, they had to, but it wasn't just then, and it wasn't just them.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, people came over here because this is the land of opportunity, so.